Blog Talk Radio.
Thanks for tuning in to Fire Engineering Talk Radio. Each week, our host will introduce you to a various cast of characters you'll only find here. Each host will share experience, knowledge, and expertise regarding their years in the fire service, allowing you to call in and speak with them live. An experience you can only find on Fire Engineering Talk Radio. So thanks for joining us. Enjoy and stay safe. Welcome to the Command Show.
Titan 5, Engine 1-1.
With Anthony Castros and Ed Hadfield. Let's start the show.
Welcome, everybody, to the Command Show. I'm Anthony Castros, and my normal partner, Ed Hadfield, is unable to join us today. He's busy with the fires in California, as a lot of our partners are throughout the state. And tonight, we're going to be talking about just that. We're going to have a call from one of our deputy chiefs at my department, Sacramento Metro Fire, also known as Metro Fire, here in Central California. We've got a lot of personnel out across the state of California tonight and over the past few weeks, because we're right in the heart of fire season out here in California. In addition, we're going to talk tonight about apartment fires. We started talking about apartment fires our last show, discussing some of the tactical options and priorities. We're going to break that down a little more tonight from both a strategy and tactic standpoint, a ICS standpoint, and an SOG standpoint, kind of the fire or operational triangle that we like to call it, so that we can have safe, effective, and efficient operations consistently around the board. So if you're out there tonight in fire service land out at a firehouse or with a group of friends or even by yourself having a beer or something, give us a call. We've got some folks already on our blog. Hello to Columbus Fire and also to Battalion 1A. You're on our radio blog chat room right now. And give us a call if you'd like. I'd love to have you. One of the things we talk about, as you all know, if you've listened to this show more than once, you know that we'd like to harp on you out there about the NIOSH 5. And we're going to do that every single show. And our goal is that everybody in the whole American Fire Service knows what the NIOSH 5 is. And it's the top causes of firefighter death. Now, we're not talking about the actual physiological causes. We're talking about the operational causes. What operational trends or deficiencies or causal factors, if you will, are leading to death of firefighters. Now, it could be argued by some that our firefighter death rate is on the decline, and it actually is. This past year, it's gone down, and primarily because of higher fitness levels, actually. But the NIOSH 5 is not just about firefighter line of duty death. It's also about saving more civilian lives. It's about being more safe and effective on the fire ground, more property saved, more effective and efficient operations. Because if you look at any botched fire operation, you could probably boil it down to one of these or multiple factors. So let's go down them one more time like we always do. Number one is inadequate or improper risk assessment. We're talking about size up. We've talked in the past on this show about the FPOD-P, Lloyd Lehman size up model. It's timeless. It's been around for 60 years, and it's still very applicable today. We've got previous shows you can download where we've talked about FPOD-P, facts, probabilities, own situation, decision, and plan of operation. Size up is often misconstrued as being an arrival report. People say that they arrived and gave a size up, or did you hear that size up on the radio? When in fact, size up is a mental process that starts, usually it should start for most of us the night before our shift, where we're thinking about things like weather, staffing, and other kinds of limitations that we can forecast. Number two on the NIOSH 5 is lack of incident command. What does that mean? It doesn't necessarily mean that we don't have an incident commander. Most fire departments around the country have an incident commander at their fires. What they don't have is the tactical level supervisors. The tactical level supervisors are the division and group supervisors, or in some systems, sector bosses, sector officers who are in charge of the tactical level. They're the ones who are seeing the bigger picture than the folks inside the smoke, inside the building, who are just attached to a nozzle or searching a room, who really aren't thinking tactically, they're thinking task level. So if we have an incident commander with multiple companies reporting to him in the neighborhood of 10, 11, 12 companies reporting to one incident commander, you can see a few things are going to happen. You're going to have bottleneck of tactical radio traffic, and your communication is going to go down because everyone's waiting in line to talk on the radio. Number two, you're going to have a bunch of companies that are only focusing on the task level, i.e. stretching a line, cutting a hole, searching a room, taking a window, and not stepping back to that 20-foot level where they can see the bigger picture and see things like roof conditions, smoke conditions, and so forth. And number three, your span of control for the incident commander is going to be blown out of proportion there. So those are just some of the examples. Number three is lack of accountability. Lack of accountability is a huge one. We're not talking about passports and FATS tags. We're talking about you knowing your job and your boss, each crew knowing their job and their boss, and each division or group supervisor knowing the crews in their division or group, and everyone knowing their job. And then number four is inadequate communications. This, as we all know, when we leave a fire ground, one of the things we all complain about is the communications. This is no big news flash, but we can improve our communications by enhancing our command structure. And then last but not least, lack of established SOPs or failure to follow the ones you have. I just got off the phone with a department that shall remain nameless in the country who doesn't even have SOPs. And unfortunately, there's a lot of departments. Actually, I spoke to two different departments today from two different states that both stated that they didn't have SOGs or SOPs operationally. So these are real issues that we're all dealing with. And these are the issues we're trying to attack, again, not just from a standpoint of preventing loss of life of firefighters or preventing line-of-duty deaths, but also from a standpoint of actually having a more safe, effective, and efficient fire ground operation. So with that, I'm going to introduce our first guest who I asked to go ahead and join us tonight on our show. He's coming to us from Sacramento, California, and we're going to talk a little bit about what's going on throughout the state of California here in the heart of fire season. Chief Cochran, are you with us?
Yeah, I'm here.
Can you hear me? Thanks for calling, Chief. Yes, I can hear you. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, thanks.
Thanks a lot for calling in, Chief. I know you're busy, and we won't take up too much of your time, but I thought I'd ask you to call in just to kind of to give the listeners out there throughout the country kind of an overview on what's going on in California, what the typical operation looks like for Metro Fire, how we're impacting the operations around the state and even in the western half of the U.S. Chief Cochran is the Deputy Chief with Metro. We're right in the center of California in the Central Valley, and so we go north, south, east, and west, and we have troops pretty much in every direction right now. So what's going on right now, Chief, with the deployments around the state?
Well, thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here. First, we'll talk about what's going on in with Metro Fire and across the state of California. With Metro Fire and the city of Sacramento and a couple of other local government resources around here, we have resources deployed to 10 different fires from northern and southern California to Idaho and into Nevada. All of our resources are either strike teams or overhead management positions. And I think at this point, at last count yesterday, we had over 120 firefighters out on different deployments across the state.
That's a huge number. Now, the 120, is that from the county of Sacramento? The total, or
yeah,
is that from Metro?
No, from the county of Sacramento is the whole 120. From Metro Fire, we have two strike teams out, which is about 22 people per strike team, plus another 15 overhead. So we're into the 50 to 60 range for deployments.
Now, I know a lot of people out there listening are probably thinking that they may not even have that many people in their entire agency. And Metro is a pretty robust agency. We consider ourselves all risk. Chief Cochran, by the way, has been intimately part of a lot of the various parts of our department operations. He's been part of our helicopter aviation program as well as our hazardous material program. So, Chief, when you talk about overhead, we've got a lot of folks in different positions. What are some examples of some of the positions in the ICS that they're filling out there on these fires?
Well, I'll just talk. As you know, Anthony, I'm on an incident management team myself. That's a federal Type 1 incident management team, Cal Team 3. My team is actually deployed in a national park. which is up in Northern California. And on that team itself, we have a liaison officer that works directly for the incident commander. We have a division chief. We have a logistics chief on a Type 1 team. We have a ordering manager, a supply unit leader, facilities unit leader. So a lot of logistical support along with occasionally operational support. A lot of the other teams that are out there that are is, again, it's a lot of logistical support. We have PIOs out. We have communications managers out. So it's a whole variety of different positions that are associated with these teams.
And I know some of the questions that are probably out there right now, and I'll check the chat room too, because we get a lot of folks ask about this. But what would you say, Chief, is the benefit of having our people gone up to 50 plus, gone right in the heart of fire season, conducting some of these operations outside of the county, outside of the state? What do they bring back to Metro that benefits us ultimately?
They bring back a huge amount of experience. They work with federal and state and local government fire agencies across the western United States, particularly with us. And then they bring back with a specific area in which they work within. One of our assistant chiefs here that, since he was a battalion chief, has been working with strike teams and division chiefs. But the operational experience that he brings back on these large wildland forest fires is tremendous. We have a logistics section chief that brings back information that we cannot gain in any other incident. The political aspect of working with multi-jurisdictional, multi-county, state and federal level is immeasurable through our agency. And as people move up within our agency, having that, even just that political piece of dealing with those large mass incidents and that insight is tremendously beneficial back to our organization.
Yeah, I totally agree with that, Chief. It's amazing what a tool in succession planning that the overhead program has been for Metro. I know that a lot of us who kind of have been unifocal to risk using a paramedic term out of context. I have no idea what unifocal means, but it sounds good. But for those of us who kind of think one-dimensionally, when you go on these out-of-county or out-of-state assignments, it really broadens your spectrum of what command can be on a large-scale incident. And actually, some of the lessons you learn on these, what Chief Cockham described as a Type 1 incident, you can bring back to your Type 4 and Type 5 structure fires. And so you mentioned the Type 1 team that you're part of, Chief. Could you kind of tell our listeners who may not understand the terminology, what is Type 1? What's that mean from a layman's standpoint?
Yeah. Well, within the ICS system, a lot of different resources are typed, you know, hazmat teams to USAR teams to rescue units to incident management teams to helicopters, dozers. Everything has a typing on it. And generally, the Type 1 is the one with the most capability. So within the U.S. Forest Service system, they have 17 of these Type 1 teams stretched across the United States. And the Type 1 team are the people with the most experience, the largest team, and are capable of dealing with the more complex fire issues. And generally, when they talk about a Type 1 team and complexity, we're talking about the number of resources that they're there to support. So generally, over 1,000 firefighters are on scene is one of the many triggers to bring in a Type 1 team. The complexity of the fire, the amount of evacuations, the amount of infrastructure that, like utilities and other infrastructures that are threatened by the fire, trip the wire for essentially a Type 1 team. Generally, in the U.S. Forest Service, there's a Type 1 team and then a Type 2 team, which is usually sent out for those smaller fires with a little bit less complexity, and they are a smaller team when they come out. So it has to deal with the magnitude of the incident that they're dealing with.
Okay. For those of you out there listening who just joined us, we're talking to Deputy Chief Scott Cockrum. He is a Deputy Chief of Metro Fire Sacramento, my department, and we're talking about large-scale incidents because we're in the midst of wildland season out here in California. He just described the fact that there's about 10 different fires going on in the state, and we've got personnel from Metro Fire out on overhead assignments, which really gives them a tremendous amount of experience to bring back to the agency. It's a great succession planning tool, and it helps you even on the day-to-day calls. Chief, you've been a line battalion chief, you've been a shift assistant chief, and now you're a deputy chief at Metro. How did your experience seeing the bigger ICS picture on your overhead Type 1 incidents, how did that help you with your day-to-day structure fire command system?
Well, just understanding the what the ICS system is, and when you're on an incident management team, they are so in-depth on what incident management is and how it works, what ICS works and how or looks like and how it works and how it develops and what the span of control and being able to distribute your workload and being able to have a manager in charge of different sections of your fire, what the incident management team does and the forest fires that I've been on really brought out the fact that if you can distribute that workload, you can accomplish a lot more with better communications and better resourcing. And the same thing with when you're on a large fire just in your own jurisdiction. Once that becomes part of your language, the incident command system and how you're going to division out, branch out, set up a fire, once that's become part of your everyday language, then when you're on one of these smaller fires, it's easier to bring out and get out and get other people to understand it. So, I think that's probably the biggest part is it's become so ingrained in my philosophy and my belief that it works, that I can make it happen.
Yeah, that's true. I know. I think a lot of us who are new officers, when we make the jump to officer, it's hard for us to delegate sometimes and trust and empower people on our incident when we're the incident commander. But these overhead teams that are so in-depth, like the chief mentioned, they break it down. Every little imaginable position in the ICS structure that you read about in a manual or in a class has a living human being in charge of it. And so you see these different components interacting at the command post, on the fire, and throughout. And so you realize that to make an incident run effectively, whether it's small or large, you need to be able to train people, to entrust them to be in charge of certain components of the incident and empower them, delegate to them. So, Chief, thanks for your time. I know you're busy. I promised you I wouldn't keep you for more than about 10 minutes because I know you got your hands full. We'll speak more about this after the chief leaves. Anything else you want to add before you get back to work?
You know what, Chief, I think what you'd mentioned before with the incident command system and is developing it, you know, we just went to a law enforcement function where they were asking me and Deputy Chief Holbrook to come in and give them a lesson on incident command and how it develops. And it is even becoming an important component of their roles and their relationships within this county of Sacramento and others. And actually, it was a federal exercise that we did this with. So understanding and development, working it, using it with your other partners within the organizations, the public safety organizations in your community in advance of that big incident is huge. So go out there, learn it, and make it happen.
Hey, Chief, thanks a lot for your time.
Thanks.
I know you're busy, and we appreciate Deputy Chief Scott Cochran from Metro Fire Sacramento. Have a good night, Chief. Thanks.
Okay, bye.
Okay. As you heard from the Chief, there's a lot going on here in California. There's a lot going on throughout the nation as well. Idaho, Nevada, as we all know, Colorado had an unprecedented amount of fires earlier this year. So there's a lot going on. And, you know, when we're talking about command, we're not just talking about house fires and apartment fires and commercial structures. We're talking about the entire gamut. And one of the things we're discussing here when it comes to incident management teams is the national incident management system, or NIMS. You know, ICS is the model for that, and ICS can truly be used on a house fire all the way up to 9/11 type of incident. And it's important to realize that the lessons that you get on the smaller incidents, if you run those well, your larger ones are going to go better, and vice versa. If you're exposed to the larger incidents and you understand how big the system can expand, you're able to then contract it back to your house fire and make that work better for you because the principles are the same. It's about span of control. It's about communication. It's about delegating authority, a modular approach, and sectioning off and divisioning and grouping off your incident so it's manageable. Here in Sacramento, we've had an unprecedented amount of structure fire activity in the past 2 months. I have not seen this much behavior in my short 25-year career. It's been pretty crazy. And with that, I've got a friend on the line from the South County area, the Consumnes Fire District. If he's still on the line, Josh Rubenstein, are you still with me, buddy?
I'm here.
How are you?
I'm doing lovely. How are you?
Good. Are you you working today?
That I am.
What's the weather up there?
What's that?
What's the weather up in Sac today?
I think we're sitting 90-92. It's cooled off a little bit, which is actually nice. We had a house fire B9 just the other day, and it was pushing 100, and it's not a lot of fun. It's 5 o'clock in the afternoon, but all good?
No, it's not. Josh, what's have you guys had much wildland work the past month or so in Battalion 10?
I have not. We've had a couple of small things, but nothing. I have not been on anything personally that's been, you know, over a couple of acres. I don't know what the rest of the battalion on the other shifts have had. We've run a couple of house fires, but nothing much in the wildland. Now we have. I tried calling on your toll-free number a couple of times, and it wouldn't allow us to access. I didn't even know if the program was going on. As was talking about here with overhead assignments, we have 5 strike teams out in NorCal, as well as 4 overhead. So our organization is maxed out on who we can send out.
Yeah, I think everybody's tapped out. We've got people all over the Western United States from the county. And for those of you who don't know what a strike team is, it's basically 5 engines. They may be a Type 1, which would be a conventional, you know, fire engine as you would see it on a street, to what we call a Type 3, which is more of a wildland urban type of engine, urban interface type of engine. And 5 of those get together. They go with a chief officer who leads them, and they become actually one resource, and that's known as a strike team, and they go out. So strike teams are very common throughout the summertime for California. We send a lot of folks out. Over the past 10 years, we've evolved where, like Josh mentioned, we're sending a ton of overhead personnel to fill division and group supervisor functions, logistics functions, operational functions like operations chiefs and branch directors and so forth, and even plans chiefs and so forth. So it's been good experience. How's your family doing, by the way? I had to ask you. I haven't talked to you for a while.
Well, on national radio, everybody's fine.
What's he supposed to say?
Just send a shout out back. No, everybody's doing good, buddy.
Okay, good. What we're going to talk about tonight is apartment fires a little bit more, to kind of pick up on what we discussed last show. Generally speaking, there's 2 types of apartment buildings. There's garden style and center hall. Now, center hall can come in a million different shapes and sizes. Back east, you've got something more like a brownstone, or you've got center scissor corridors or different types of stair assemblies inside. In California, you're probably not going to have something that looks like that, but the principle is the same. In a center hall apartment building, you're going to have the occupants of the building have to exit their apartment into another interior exit route or egress, means of egress. And in so doing, they are that much more susceptible to products of combustion, fire, smoke, heat, and it becomes much more difficult for them to escape. Contrast that with a garden-style apartment complex where the actual unit exit, the door to the unit exits to the outside atmosphere. So this is, you can imagine the tactical challenges of each one. The more lethal is the center hall type of construction. When we talk about ICS, you cannot talk about ICS without keeping in context strategy and tactics. Those two have to be married, left and right hand, have to be working together to make an overall fire ground operation successful. They don't operate in separate vacuums. They have to be interrelated. With that in mind, the last component is your SOGs or your standard operating guidelines or standard operating procedures operationally. Those 3 things, you bolt them together, and they become what we like to call the operational triangle. And that operational triangle hopefully will yield safe, effective, and efficient operations for you. So with that in mind, we also talk about something called the incident command formula, the ICS formula, if you will. That is a combination of your building that you're dealing with, the fire conditions you're dealing with, and the amount of resources that you have on scene to mitigate the problem. Those 3 things come together to kind of spit out what your ICS would be. For example, if you have an apartment fire where you're relatively certain because it's midday that everyone's evacuated, and it's a garden style apartment fire, and it's on, let's say, the second floor of a two-story apartment, you can probably get away with division two, for example, on the second floor, and division one on the first floor, and roof division. You take that same fire and put it in the middle of the night, and you have a potential for rescue problems, and you know you have confirmed rescues. You may choose to use a fire attack group and a rescue group. If the fire is contained in one unit or two, you can just have the fire attack group attack that, check for extension, and the rescue group go for multiple victims that are potentially there. So there's a lot of ways to skin the ICS cat. There's not one way or the only way. We talk about that a lot in our video series, Mastering Fire Ground Command, Calming the Chaos from Fire Engineering. We get into that in much more detail, and we'll have a lot of videos and simulations for that. So let's, as we keep this in mind, we're gonna bring on another caller here from the 916 area code, 402-3656. Who do we have from 916?
Hey, good afternoon. Hello? Anthony. Good afternoon, Anthony. It's Eldorado Hills Fire Department calling in.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Hey, it's going really good. I just had a kind of a quick question, kind of a quick thought. Well, first of all, for people that don't know, we're protecting kind of the east side of Sacramento, and have had some pretty good wildland fires up here already with the Salmon Fire and then the 49er Fire the other day. Hey, just real quick, you know, smaller departments, we're just a four-station department. We've had some problems with communications arriving on structure and multifamily dwellings, and with the problem mostly just the accountability factor, trying to get that set up on the initial phase of the incident. Any thoughts on how smaller departments handle all of that radio traffic and accountability in the early phase? We've almost considered going to more of a assistant to the chief that just really listens to the radio and does nothing but listen to the radio and help, kind of organize the radio traffic to the ops chief.
Right. Great question. One of the things that we are working on doing is keeping it simple. For example, the first companies to an incident into a, let's just call it a house fire like you're talking about, you don't necessarily need to set up interior or division A or fire attack group or whatever. Those initial companies working are going to be very task saturated. They're going to be stretching line, getting a water supply, forcible entry. They're going to be meeting up with potentially hazardous conditions and an IDLH that could be even zero visibility. So because of that, they're sphere of awareness goes down to potentially zero because of smoke. It's certainly less than 6 feet, so their sphere of awareness is very minimal. You add to that the emotional element. You add to that the noise element of not just the radio traffic, but potentially chainsaws, idling engines, sirens, people yelling at them. And the average task-level firefighter doesn't have a whole lot of situational awareness. That's why they yell a lot on the radio, because they don't have the presence of mind to package their message. They're just blurting out whatever comes to mind. Conversely, they also don't hear much. The first thing to go when you get a certain amount of beats per minute is your hearing. So you start to get auditory exclusion. And that's a phenomenon that you see on the fire ground. People, that's why you have to call people two and three times on a fire on the radio, is because of auditory exclusion. So to combat that, one of the things we've trained on is to go over and over and over simply the radio traffic on your average fire. Now, you can't forecast exactly what you're going to say all the time. But the things you can focus on are, what are you going to call each other? What are the types of communications that are critical in those first 3 to 5 minutes, and what other things are not critical? For example, if Engine 1 shows up to the house fire first, let's not call him fire attack. Let's not call him interior. Let's not call him Division A or as Ed likes to call him, Camp Snoopy Director. He's simply Engine 1. And that helps him out because that's his designator usually most of the time, and he's at the task level. So if you're working at the task level stretching a line, you're only going to be called by your designator and not an ICS designator. You're going to be called by your single unit identifier. Does that make sense so far?
Yeah, sure does.
Okay, and so if you've got, let's say, Engine 1 initiates fire attack, and they're just stretching the line, Engine 2 shows up and assumes command, and they have their crew stretching a second two out line or backup line, whatever your terminology is, then you really should, as the incident commander, only be talking to engine one and engine two. Now let's say the chief arrives and he assumes command from engine two's captain, which is commonplace. Now that engine two captain can become a division or group supervisor with those two crews working for him. One of the crews may be his own crew, and one of the crews may be engine one. So, but the point is those crews don't change names in the middle of a fight. You don't want to tell somebody right in the middle of smoke that they can't see their hand in front of their face, where they can't hear much radio traffic, okay, all of a sudden now you're Division A. You don't change on them. I've been guilty of that. It doesn't work very well. So once they're at the task level, keep them at their unit identifier. The next guy in is probably going to be a division or group supervisor. And by doing that early, what you've set up is somebody who can start accounting for everyone right now, not 20 minutes into it when there's three or four or five or six companies on scene, but actually what we like to call active accountability. So your second or even third company to the hazard zone becomes your division or group supervisor. Their job is to corral the crews in their division or group and then start active accountability. Instead of relying on a FATS board or a series of T-cards in a pouch outside somewhere that's probably behind the curve, you actually have active accountability right away. So in this case, let's say they went in the A side, we're going to call them Division A, or let's say it's a smaller building and you choose to use the term interior for those operations for smaller homes, that officer becomes that division supervisor, and he is responsible for engines one and two, and anybody else who goes in his division. And now, as that division grows, the incident commander is not burdened with trying to track two, three, four, five companies. He's only talking to that one division supervisor, and that division supervisor is the one talking to the crews in his division and as they get fed to him. And what that does is that number one, it keeps the crews at the task level as their single unit identifiers. Number two, it gives you an accountability officer who's actually hands-on in straddling the hazard zone, non-hazard zone, that tactical place between the incident commander and the task level crews. And three, it reduces communication because now that division soup can walk around, do face-to-face communications with his crews or even on the radio if he needs to, and consolidate critical pieces of information back to command. And we've seen this on countless fires that we've run where it really streamlines, if you will, the communication process and the accountability. Instead of waiting till we're 10, 50 minutes saying, oh my gosh, we better get FATS going. Oh, we better start a FATS board. Do you know where everybody is? No. And then wasting all this radio traffic to find everybody. But conversely, we also don't want to have five engines on scene and every one of them have a label, you know, fire, tech, rescue, medical, with only five companies. So it's kind of a balancing act where you don't over-organize it, but you also don't wait too long and get behind the power curve. Does that make sense?
I think that's our problem probably, is that we're actually kind of a little bit behind the power curve. We're trying to get all that set up in the initial phase, and then we miss some of that radio traffic and that accountability, and then, throw in a kind of a chatty chief, and, that's where we start to get in trouble.
No names, though, of course, right? No names. But, yeah, I think that's the common problem we see in the American Fire Service. You know, we are reactive by nature. We're firefighters. So, you know, we're one of the only American workplaces with recliners. So our nature is to react. And I mean, we don't even like fire prevention. You know, we don't like anything proactive. We like to wait until something's burning or dying or screaming before we do something. And unfortunately, ICS falls under that same detrimental philosophy. Once the incident commander starts to feel, the average incident commander will wait till he feels overwhelmed before he creates a division or group. The average incident commander will wait to worry about accountability until he realizes he doesn't have it. The average incident commander will try and get another tactical channel or clean up communications once they're chaotic, and that's not okay. That's like saying the average incident commander pulls everybody out of the building after the roof goes in. It's just as ridiculous to say that as it is to say those other statements. So we need to be ahead of the power curve. And one of the tools we've used at our command training center is our tabletops. We have everybody in the table standing around the table with headsets on the tech channel, so there's no feedback. Everyone's holding their little engine or truck or medic or whatever it is. and we go through the cadence of that initial arrival sequence. Kind of like the 49ers used to have those first, remember Bill Walsh used to have those first 15 plays, you know, to get the game rolling, you know. Obviously in our job, you don't know exactly what you're going to have, and you don't know exactly what it's going to look like, so you can't expect to be scripted, and this is not about checkbox command. We're not talking about rote memory, and we're not talking about taking your brains out of your head and making you a robot. We're talking about getting so good at communication that we can anticipate each other's comments, commands, and triggers. For example, we don't say assume fire attack in my department because we know that assume means you're going to take over a division, a group, or command. So we use the term initiate. So the first arriving engine doesn't say I'm assuming a fire attack. He'll say I'm initiating fire attack, which tells everybody else he's just getting hose on the ground. He needs help. He's not going to answer to the term fire attack. He's not going to answer to the term interior, division A. He's going to answer to the term engine one, for example. And he is at the task level, and that's all you can expect of him. And that's actually very helpful, because how many times have you heard a fire where everyone's calling everybody else multiple different names until they figure out which one they answer to?
Yeah, it happens all the time.
Yeah, and so this really clarifies that. And the second thing is we say, okay, if you're assuming a division, I'm going to assume division A or roof division or whatever. That means you're at the tactical level. And now you're responsible for multiple companies and for tactical decision-making and accountability. And you are essentially the safety officer for that division or group. And so that takes the burden off of command. And that puts the active accountability in the hands of that division or group soup, who actually can see and touch the crews in his division or group, not the incident commander in an air-conditioned VC buggy across the street sipping a mint julep while he's looking at some make-believe, you know, bunch of you know, cards or, you know, Velcro tags. This is an actual accountability level where, and a lot of people say, well, you can't do that. How can you account for people in a smoky environment? Or, you know, you're not going to have much accountability and zero visibility. And you know what? The answer is you're right. But what I'm going to have is control of the access point that they went into. I'm going to have control of when they went in and when they should be coming out. I'm going to be thinking about things like air management. And I'm also going to be looking over their head at fire conditions, roof conditions, building construction conditions. And if I have to, the astute division or group supervisor should have their full turnouts on their SCB on their back and should click in. If you need to walk into your hazard zone and follow a hose line a few feet in to get that face-to-face with your crews, then do it. I've done it many, many times, and it works great. And obviously, if all else fails, you call them on the radio. But more often than not, I would say at least 80% of the time, the active division or group soup can get face-to-face communication with his crews in the hazard zone and then step back out a little bit away from the action and then talk to command on resource needs, CAN reports, and so forth. So I know that's a way, way long answer to your question, but I don't know if it helped or not.
No, it helped. Thanks for taking the call. We appreciate it.
Yeah, well, thanks for calling in. You guys are afraid to ask anything else now, huh, because it'll be another 25 minutes.
No, we appreciate it. Take care of yourself. Take care of your family.
You too. Thanks a lot for calling in, guys.
Thank you, Beth.
Okay, everybody. We've got some nice stuff coming in from our chat room right now. One of the questions here is fire attack a term of ICS? And you know, it's funny because a lot of people will criticize the term fire attack or interior because they say, well, that's not an ICS term. Here's the thing about ICS. ICS is a tool, and it's expandable. You're not going to limit your terminology to what's in some manual. You're going to use whatever terminology is appropriate and that you've trained upon so that everyone understands it. For example, if you're on a large-scale wildland fire and there's a branch instead of a several divisions are clumped into a branch because it's so large, they may call that branch Branch 1. They may call it Hamilton Branch because it's a Hamilton neighborhood or jurisdictional area. There's no ICS police to come and throw you in jail and give you a ticket because you used it wrong. We have to get past that and say, you know, fire attack, if you choose to use the term fire attack as a group, then that makes sense, use it. If you choose to use the term interior as a division for smaller buildings because it's so small that one person can lap the structure, then use it. But the notion that you can't use a certain type of terminology is us. I think when we do that, we get ourselves wrapped up around the axle a little too much. One of the questions here says here, the California wildfires are impacting all of us from large to small departments. With that being said, are we being impacted with having acting officers and acting engineers fill our seats? This is becoming a great opportunity for new officers too. Yeah, it is. You know, hopefully we have got an opportunity. We recognize this not only as an opportunity for our officers to go out and deploy and get large-scale incident experience and bring that back, but it's an opportunity for some of our acting officers potentially to backfill them. That's a great point. It's more on that succession planning. There needs to be a method to the madness. What we don't want to do, though, in my opinion, is just throw anybody into the seat and call them an acting lieutenant, captain, or chief, and just throw them in there haphazardly without proper training, mentoring, and so forth. At Metro, we use task books. Following, again, the wildland model, we use task books extensively. We also have been developing different officer academies to help with that training. Another couple of questions here. The sets and reps, one of the comments here from Battalion 1A out there, we found that sets and reps really helped with improving our comms, order model, et cetera. Could not agree with you more. The sets and reps is what we call our exercises in our simulation lab in our command training center, which is modeled after the Phoenix model and the Brunicini folks. So sets and reps is where you're just getting used to do it over and over and over, where you're looking, everyone should look at a house fire and see the same things. We should all see where the ideal hose line placement should be. It shouldn't be a debate anymore. We should be professional. We should recognize where to put the hose line, what type of ventilation is needed based on the resources we have, what type of ICS we should set up. It shouldn't be a roll of the dice every time. So sets and reps really do help. But you don't have to be fancy. Just get out a piece of paper and some pencils and draw some stuff on a whiteboard. Look at your average fire engineering magazine cover and talk about some of these things. We talked about a PAR, a Personnel Accountability Report. It's an acronym. When we say do a PAR, what we're talking about there is accounting for everyone. We need to be thinking of accountability as an active process, not a reactive process. If you're running a group or division or a sector, and someone says, give me a PAR, the incident commander says, can you give me a PAR of your crews? You shouldn't have to wait and think about it. You should instantly know. You should instantly know that you have everyone or you don't. It shouldn't be a reactive process, and that's the thing about command. Command is unfortunately so reactive. And the reason is why that it's so reactive, in my opinion, is that as incident commanders, we are the last to know everything. Everyone at the tip of the spear on the hose line knows what's going on. The tactical division of group supervisors knows what's going on. But by the time the incident commander gets this information on who's in what division or what group or who's doing what or what the conditions are, that key decision maker is the last to know and so therefore reacts. Another reason is that incident commander is overwhelmed, obviously, with multiple companies, tactical channels, radio traffic, incoming units, and a bunch of different inputs that aren't necessary most of the time. So by making groups and divisions, you delegate your authority and responsibility. You tell those division and group supervisors through training that, you know what, you can make tactical decisions on the fire. Should they be in concert with the overall strategy? Absolutely. Should the incident commander be aware of them as soon as possible? Yes, but there are going to be tactics that are employed before the incident commander ever knows about them, and that's a good thing. Delegating that, decentralizing that authority and responsibility is critical, and therefore you get more eyes and brains on the fire ground making tactical decisions instead of just one person at a command post. Because you got to remember that command post is oftentimes a very one-dimensional view of the fire. Maybe at best it's a corner where you have an Alpha Bravo corner view of the fire, maybe. most of the time you don't even have that. You could even be down the street behind apparatus at the end of a cul-de-sac, you know, around the block in a large city. So it's really imperative that we empower officers to be division or group supervisors making tactical decisions. So that's another one. One of the other things, the idea of a safety officer, you know, a safety officer is obviously an important role. But let's not forget that a good division or group officer, division or group supervisor, is a safety officer for his or her division or group. If you were to have a large apartment fire, for example, the last one I had that was decent size was about 250 by 250 feet. One safety officer, the notion that one safety officer would be able to make that incident any safer is ludicrous. We have to realize that we need multiple safety officers to see multiple sides of the fire at the same time. The best people to do that are your division and group supervisors. Instead of 12 safety officers, your division and group supervisors become safety officers by the fact that they're in the tactical position. They're closer than the incident commander to the fire to see what's going on, but they're not so deep in it like the crews on the hose lines that they can't see their hand in front of their face. Okay. A comment here from Battalion 1A: with the implementation of active accountability, accountability is a much smoother and accurate process. Yes, it is, and thank you. I got a great one here from one of you. Hey, don't you live near the ocean? How many fish can you name? I can name one, salmon. It's really good to eat. So the notion of active accountability is something I hope those of you out there listening consider. Because it's truly an active process. So let's go back to the apartment fires. When we have a center hall type of building, you're going to have a much more lethal situation. So call additional companies early. Don't get behind the power curve on that. Just because you've got a little to no fire visible, if you've got a decent amount of smoke out of a large building, especially center hall, call more alarms. If you're in a department that is not resource rich and you only get maybe two-man engines on a fire, call additional alarms en route or once you hit the ramp. Conversely, a center hall apartment, while still having a lot of people in the building, is less lethal because we have an opportunity for them to escape out into the outside atmosphere much quicker. And so, therefore, the types of tactics are a little different. Hose line placement's a little different in a center hall than in a garden style because of that element of the internal hallways and stairwells. You're looking at protecting stairwells and hallways. You're looking at different ventilation characteristics to get people out. One of the best things you can do out there is to pre-plan. A lot of departments go out and they pre-plan these large commercial buildings, which is great. But if it was up to me and what I tell my crews, is go out and pre-plan your apartments, pre-plan your apartment buildings. That's where your largest fire hazard, or I should say life hazard is, your largest target hazard for life loss is in your apartments. Start with the center halls, work your way through to the garden styles. Maybe you've got a apartment building that's got a lot of nuisance fires. You know, there's arsonists lurking around. Maybe you know you've got a lot of invalids, your care facilities, these types of facilities. Those are the ones you want to target. We had a three-alarm apartment fire in October in one of these three-story center halls, and we had done so much pre-planning that we had built models of the building. We've done simulations of the building. It's actually on the cover of video number 2 in our video series from Fire Engineering. And so we were able to hit the ground running. There was no doubt as to the layout of the building, construction, hallway, and stairwell features, the length, the stretch needed, the tactics to employ, the type of fire we had in location. We had pre-planned that so many times that we were able to have very little reflex time on the tactics that we employed. So these are things to consider. When we're talking about a known rescue of a house, a duplex, a fourplex, or a garden-style apartment where the fire is maybe one or two units, a good ICS model, and I'm not saying it's the only one, I'm saying one to consider when you have a known rescue situation, is the fire attack group, rescue group, medical group, and roof division or ventilation group model. You immediately take your alarms down to a 4-to-1 span of control. And some of you have seen the video that showcases this model. If you go, you can go to our website at www.trainfirefighters.com. That's one word with an S on the end, trainfirefighters.com. And on our homepage there, you can click on a link that will take you to a fire we had a couple years ago. The crews did an amazing job. You'll see wonderful fire ground pace. And we used the model there in that fire of that 4-to-1 span of control. We had actually two separate commercial alarms responding simultaneously to this fire, and that gave me about a 22-to-1 span of control, but we broke it down to 4-to-1, which made it much easier to accomplish what we needed to. And I'm happy to say that the child you see in that video, you'll see a child in that video come out lifeless. The engineer from Truck 106, Brent Barswell, comes running out with him over his shoulder, and he's lifeless, not breathing. CO level's 23. And that same little guy that you see lifeless on the gurney with no respirations was walked out of the hospital a week later with no deficits. So give all the glory to God on that one, because he was watching over us on that incident. It's just a good example of this model we're talking about. It was a garden-style apartment. There was one a unit very well involved. Three other units were threatened in becoming involved with a common breezeway in the open garden format that was feeding the fire to the other units. But it worked out. We had worked through that type of fire in that scenario several times, so that in the command training center, so that when we actually hit the street and had that fire, I knew the type of ICS I was going to use the moment I arrived on scene. The crews knew the terminology I was going to be using and who was going to be working for whom. And that's real critical. And it keeps your radar traffic down to a minimum when we do that. So some other considerations on apartment fires is, you know, we always, a lot of firefighters will, if you ask a room full of 100 firefighters and you tell them to close their eyes and you say, whom of you thinks in the average apartment fire that the number one priority is the hose line, half of them will raise their hand. If you say, you know, who of you thinks that the rescue is the first priority, the other half will raise their hand. And we all know that it's based on your conditions, based on the building and the fire conditions. But at the end of the day, we're going to have limited information on fire conditions, victim location, building layout when we arrive at 2 in the morning. So what you need is strong command and control. So what the fire attack rescue group model does for you when you break your fire into those two groups is it gives an immediate direction to the chaos, to two of the most critical functions of that fire gun, which is the hose line and the rescue component. You need to have them both happen simultaneously. But if you have a bunch of schizophrenic firefighters who are all of them are thinking in their mind, well, should we go for a hose line or should we go for the grab? Or, you know, they see something that tells them, I got to get the hose line in there because I learned that you put the fire out, the problem goes away. But then you see somebody else who sees a window and they think, I got to VES this window. But it's all happening randomly. That's not going to be a good fire ground operation, and you're probably not going to get the outcome you want. However, if you say, all right, engine one, you're initiating a fire attack. Okay, I'm going to give you engine two as your fire attack group supervisor. And those two companies are just focusing on water on the fire, hose line deployment, and I'll feed you your resources. Engine three and truck one, you're going to be, engine three, you're initiating a search. Truck one, you're coming behind them. You're going to become rescue group supervisor. You've got engine three working for you. You're focused on search and rescue. Go. Now you've broken the fire into those two critical elements of fire attack and search and rescue, and you're off to the races. The next two tactical objectives, obviously, are going to be ventilation of some sort. So you create a ventilation group with the same model. And then maybe it's a roof division if you have crews on the roof. And then obviously, the medical component. Now, some agencies and some regions have the luxury of having a lot of chief officers. Probably one of the most chief officer-rich regions or towns in the country is San Francisco Fire Department. San Francisco Fire has a lot of chief officers, and very seldom do their captains or lieutenants take over a group division or group. But there's a lot of us in the country that don't have that many chief officers. So it's imperative that you at least train your captains, your lieutenants, train your company officers to become division and group supervisors. Even if they don't fulfill the role on that particular fire, they better understand that role, how to support that role, how they report to that position, and so forth. And it's a great succession planning tool. But it gets them thinking tactically. then on that dark and stormy night when your second chief is you know 20 minutes out or across town or stuck in traffic, you're not slave to chief officers to create groups and divisions. You can actually allow your lieutenants and captains to run some groups and divisions. The caveat is what do you do with the crew of the lieutenant or captain that runs a group or division? Well, it's called training. Obviously, you're going to probably want to position that crew in a non-ideal H atmosphere, like an exposure line, possibly two out, possibly water supply. If that's not an option for you, then if you've got a senior crew, then possibly they can operate in the fire ground without their company officer. That happens all the time. Crews split on often. Truck companies will split, and the senior member of the crew will take the half of the crew that doesn't have the captain. So that's an option. But the key is accountability while you do that. So these are just some random thoughts we're throwing out there. When you've got just one of us on the show and the other one's working, we're kind of balancing the call board, the chat room, and the dialogue at the same time. And the dialogue is actually a monologue. So another comment here, active accountability works well for us, and the cruise companies make this happen along with the embedded safety officer concept. I'm really happy to hear that. It's important that we all understand the different roles on the fire ground, because you're working with and among them, and you could take over them. You know, one of the components of a good military outfit is that everyone knows everyone else's job to a degree, because you never know when you're going to be put in that position. Just because of the nature of the firefight. You never know when you're going to step up into a role of supervision that you didn't expect to be in. Question just came up. As an IC, do you personally complete a 360 size up on an appropriate size building? The answer to that is typically no. Typically, as a battalion chief, I come in after the first or second engine company or truck are on scene. So I have the luxury of not having to do that. I will ask if the first in captain hasn't performed the 360, I ask that of the second captain at the very least. If the first in captain doesn't give me a 360 report, I usually will ask him why. Why did that not happen? And if there's a legitimate reason, okay, I get it. But I'll always ask at least the second captain to do that for me. There have been rare occasions where I'm first on scene and I'll drive around a building. If I can get out, sometimes I will, but very rarely do I get out, because what happens then is I get sucked into the tactical and potentially task level. I will miss radio traffic unless I have both portables ready to go, which is probably not a good thing. But we do get it as soon as possible. But great, great question, and it's obviously an educated question, because you're asking if it would be on a appropriate size building. The key is they'll get that 360. My friend Mike Alder from Prince San Bernardino City, he talks about his dynamic risk assessment, that is essentially the same thing, doing that 360 as soon as possible. It's amazing, amazing how different a fire looks from the back than the front. You think you've got it all dialed, and you go to the back and realize you're on a mountainside, you're on a hillside, or that the rear of the structure is collapsed. I had a house fire last year where the rear of the structure was partially collapsed, and they had crews get trapped briefly. If you look at the San Francisco double fatal fire last year that we reviewed on this show, the back of the building, the fire was blowing out the bottom floor, and they didn't even know it. There was just a chimney effect out the top where they were going in. I cannot overemphasize the importance of a 360. With that in mind, let's go back to NIOSH, the top five. Number one, inadequate or improper risk assessment. I won't say I'll guarantee you, but I would wager that most of that is about not getting a lap. And again, it's not about once. The fire and the building are dynamic things. They're changing. So you need to be orbiting, implying that there's a constant lapping going on. In a smaller building, less than 3,000 square foot house, room and contents, not a lot going on, that would be something where an interior division supervisor might work for you. You have a much larger home, 10,000 square foot mansion style, maybe you have an Alpha and a Charlie on both sides, and they're kind of orbiting their half of the building. So these are things to consider. Great questions. Another question just came up from Columbus. What's a trench cut, and do you use them? Trench cut. Yes, we use them. Trench cuts are a defensive ventilation cut where you literally cut a trench in the roof typically from bearing wall to bearing wall or from firewall to firewall to cut off the lateral spread of a fire. It's defensive because we're riding off a certain portion of the building, and we're going to use that cut to relieve the fire at the cut and hopefully be able to hold it. It in and of itself, it doesn't work, but when you get crews underneath it appropriately, then it can hold the fire for you at a firewall or another natural break for you. Oftentimes, these are also called strip cuts. Do we use them? Yeah, we use them a lot. They work well. The key is coordination. One of the things we need to do when we have a trench cut or a strip cut going on is we need to set that up with some proactive heat cuts or offensive cuts closer to over the fire to slow the fire's progress to give us time to make the trench or strip cut. There's two types. There's offensive and defensive cuts. An offensive strip cut or trench cut would be on the fire side of a firewall where you think you've got plenty of time and you've got a good escape route. However, what I've seen many times is if we've got a fire that's really moving and we don't have that kind of time and we have a parapet firewall that's not easy to jump over, we might do a defensive strip cut where we cut the strip on the uninvolved side of the firewall and then reinforce the firewall from the uninvolved sides to reinforce like you would reinforce a road or a riverbed in a wildland fire. Same type of concept. So it just depends on how much time you have, the building size, and so forth. Great questions from the chat room. Thank you, guys. So, again, the format we talked about a little bit was fire attack, rescue group, ventilation group, and medical group, the four key components in a known rescue. Now, obviously, if you have a large-scale building, a multi-story center hall, high-rise, a large assisted living facility, 3, 4, 5 stories, that format's probably not going to work for you. You're going to probably need to set up divisions, one per floor as appropriate, starting with the fire floor and above and working your way down. But if you have, again, a house, a duplex, a fourplex, a condominium, a small center hall fire situation where you've got maybe 2 or 3 units going, but it's not a huge fire where you think you can have one supervisor take care of it, then that format works good for you, that known rescue format. So just a couple things I want to talk about before we close for the night. Want to throw out a big thank you to number one, to God, because without him, we're not here, and he's watching over us. Number two, Bobby Halton. Thanks, Bobby, for all you do for us, for fire engineering, and for FDIC coming up in 2013. Thanks to Diane Feldman for all that she does for fire engineering and for us, and also my cohort, Eddie Hadfield. He's working tonight and no doubt busy down in Southern California. He was on a strike team earlier this week, actually. Couple of things to let you know about our DVD series, again, from Fire Engineering. It's Mastering Fireground Command, Calming the Chaos, 3-part series. We're hoping to expand that to some of these all-risk, larger-scale incidents that we were just talking about tonight. You can get that at fireengineeringbooks.com. You can read more about it and see some footage from it on our website, which is www.trainedfirefighters.com. Also, Ed's website for his training is firetowntrainingspecialist.com, and we're going to be in Monterey, Eureka, Fresno, Anaheim, throughout California this year, as well as Washington State, Illinois, and Nebraska. Give us a call or an email at trainedfirefighters.com. Our email address is info@trainedfirefighters.com. If we can help you out with any of this stuff, including officer development and assessment centers. Question here from the chat room before we go. Do you have any tips for developing a common command process among different departments that run regularly together in the first alarm environment? Great question. We actually have a regional SOG in the Sacramento region that we're using for command. And it really helps everyone who's overlapping with each other in the automatic aid environment on that first alarm to kind of get on the same page. What I would do from tips to develop your own is I would suggest that you get a working group or team together. Don't call it a committee because we all know what committees do. Get a team together and stakeholders from each agency and have them sit in a room and work it out and use that as the tip of the spear for your overall regional SOGs. We've got some real good ones that are working really well. We've got four agencies that operate off the same sheet of music because we run with each other all the time. So if you have more questions about that or would like some copies of those, some examples, just email me at info@trainfirefighters.com. I'm going to put that on the chat room too, and I'd be happy to send them to you. So any more questions from the chat room while I write that out there? Let's see, info@trainfirefighters.com. Okay, everybody. Thanks for listening tonight, and thanks for tuning in on the chat room. And God bless to everybody, and keep it safe out there. And remember, it's not about being safe. That's not good enough. Like my friend Dave Dodson says, and I really take this to heart, it's about making it safe. So thanks, God bless, and we'll see you out there.
Science 5.